From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
You gotta do certain things. It's business. We're soldiers. We follow codes.
Today, we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the premiere of The Sopranos. I'll give an appreciation, and we'll listen back to interviews with the show's creator, David Chase, and with Edie Falco, who played Tony's wife, Carmela.
Carmela!
You have made a fool of me for years with these whores. Now it's come into our home?
You were telling me before there's episodes you have never seen.
Yeah, I didn't want to see him with other women.
Really?
That was the part that I found harder to, that Edie found harder to see.
And culture critic Soraya Nadia McDonald reviews the third season of HBO's True Detective. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of The Sopranos, which premiered on TV this week back in 1999, the same year as NBC's The West Wing, and ushered in what I consider the platinum age of television. In a few minutes, we'll hear an interview from our archives with David Chase, who created The Sopranos, the hugely influential HBO drama series which was memorable and innovative from start to finish, especially the finish. But let's begin at the beginning. When The Sopranos premiered on January 10, 1999, telling the story of a mob boss who visits a psychiatrist, it was on the heels of a movie that had just approached a similar subject, but as a comedy. Analyze This, starring Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro. And while The Sopranos could be outrageously funny at times, this HBO drama series was taking the same idea very seriously. In the opening episode, Lorraine Bracco was introduced as Dr. Melfi, who greets a reluctant new patient, New Jersey mob boss Tony Soprano, played by a relatively unknown but supremely talented actor named James Gandolfini. And right away, the pacing and the dialogue let it be known that The Sopranos was something truly different. Not only for how its characters spoke and what they said, but for what was left unsaid.
My understanding from Dr. Cusimano, your family physician, is that you collapsed, possibly a panic attack. You were unable to breathe.
They said it was a panic attack. Of course, all the blood work and the neurological work came back negative. And they sent me here.
You don't agree that you had a panic attack? How are you feeling now?
Good. Fine. Back at work.
What line of work are you in?
Waste management consultant. Look, it's impossible for me to talk to a psychiatrist.
Any thoughts at all on why you blacked out?
I don't know. Stress, maybe.
As creator David Chase outlined, The Sopranos was kind of like a mafia version of the Dick Van Dyke Show. The show's central protagonist was followed both at work and at home, with lots of characters populating both places. Tony Soprano's work was mostly illegal, and his work family was his crime family, where even the closest of family members could surprise and disappoint. As in this scene, in which Tony reveals to fellow gangster Polly Walnuts, played by Tony Sirico, that a member of their inner circle has been talking to the feds.
He's wearing a wire.
Who?
Pussy.
Well, get the out of here. Huh, pussy?
Don't know how long.
Are you sure about this, Tony?
90%. Not enough to do what needs to be done.
Oh, Jesus, Tony, I'm dreaming here.
And get used to it. I've been walking in the walls all week.
I'll do it.
My responsibility.
Tony, you waited a long time for the stripes. This is one of the perks. I'll do it.
We need to be 110% sure. I want you to see it. I want you to see that wire strapped on his body. I want you to see it. You hear me? I want you to see it. Otherwise, all bets are off. You understand? This is our friend we're talking about here. You say it. You understand?
I understand.
So that's Tony at work. And at home, things are just as tense. He has a wife, two kids, and a very overbearing mother, and all of them have lots of attitude. As The Sopranos began and developed, the three most important supporting characters in Tony's life were women: his therapist, his mother, and his wife. The wife, Carmela, was played by Edie Falco. We'll hear Terry's interview with Falco in the second half of today's show. She played a no-nonsense prison guard on HBO's Oz, the Tom Fontana drama that had premiered 2 years before, paving the way for The Sopranos. And she was no-nonsense as Carmela, too, When Tony took Carmela out to dinner and began to confide in her, she moved her wine glass closer to him for a reason.
Carmela, something I gotta confess. What are you doing?
Getting my wine in position to throw in your damn face.
You're always with the drama, you.
You go ahead and confess already, please. Get it over with.
I'm on Prozac.
Oh my God.
I've been seeing a therapist.
Oh my God. I think that's great. I think that's so wonderful. I think that's so gutsy.
All right, take it easy.
But I just think that's very, very wonderful.
Well, you think I was Hannibal Lecter before or something?
I just think it's great. Psychology doesn't address the soul. That's something else. But this is a start. This is something. Oh, I'm going to shut up now. I'll shut up now.
Their relationship stayed central throughout the series and provided many of its best and most intense scenes. But the other key relationship between Tony and his mother, Livia, was cut short early on when the actress playing her, the great Nancy Marchand, died unexpectedly. But while Tony's mother was around, she always was a major source of drama and tension.
The point is, I talked to Mrs. DiCaprio over there, and she says she's got a corner suite available with a woods view. It's available now, but it's going to go fast.
Of course it's available. Somebody died.
Oh, Ma, you got to stop. You got to stop with this black poison cloud all the time, because I can't take it anymore.
Oh, poor you.
Yet nothing about The Sopranos, neither its gangster scenes nor its family squabbles, made as much impact as the abrupt, unexpected ending to the show's final episode. It has established itself by now as one of the most famous finales in the history of television. Did Tony die when that last episode suddenly cut to black and the music stopped? Many people think so, but I think they're wrong. I think Tony went on living and worrying, but we just weren't witness to it anymore. David Chase just snipped the tape, like the Beatles ended I Want You, She's So Heavy at the end of side one of Abbey Road. In between the opening therapy session and the abrupt end to Journey's Don't Stop Believin', The Sopranos changed television in several measurable ways. By making the central character more of a bad guy than a hero, it paved the way for Vic Mackey in FX's The Shield, Walter White in AMC's Breaking Bad, and every other conflicted, complicated TV character since. One of the writers on The Sopranos, Matt Weiner, even went on to develop his own conflicted central character in AMC's Mad Men. Also, other TV shows paid more attention to their choice of music after The Sopranos. TV showrunners had even more clout, and it became more accepted for series to produce fewer episodes per season and often to take more time off between seasons. And in the shows themselves, sudden deaths and unexplained twists became more common. The Sopranos, after one season, was the first cable drama to be nominated for an Emmy as Outstanding Drama Series, and 5 years later was the first cable series to win in that category. TV is better, much better, because The Sopranos premiered 20 years ago. In 2000, Terry interviewed David Chase at the end of the second season of The Sopranos and just days after the death of actress Nancy Marchand. Terry played a clip that day with Tony, played by James Gandolfini, sitting alone at night in his kitchen having a drink as his daughter Meadow walks in. She's played by Jamie Lynn Sigler.
Why are you sitting in the dark?
I don't know. Light the dark. Sit.
I gotta go online.
Oh, come on. Sit for a minute. Come on. So what's going on?
With what?
Whatever, I don't know. What's going on?
I just told you. The chat room. Is that it?
You know I love you, right, man?
Dad.
No, don't dad me. Come on. I want to know. Do you know that I love you?
Yes. I know that you love me.
Well, your mother doesn't think I love you enough.
Can you listen to her?
Everything I do, and everything I've done, and everything I will do, it's all for you and your buddy, you know that?
I think you should go to bed.
I mean, I tell people, you're like your mother, but you're all me. Nothing gets by you, and I know you think I'm a hypocrite.
I'm going to bed.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
Dad, why don't you go to bed?
I'm gonna finish my drink.
Okay. Can I?
Good night, baby.
Sometimes we're all hypocrites.
Good night, baby.
We are so lucky to have found in James Gandolfini someone who has such an interesting face to watch, and his face is kind of mercurial. I mean, although I'm sure he's trying not to betray what he's thinking, you can see what he's thinking on his face. And sometimes he looks very weak and vulnerable, and sometimes he's incredibly cold-blooded looking. You've cast at the center of the series someone who is a very charismatic actor, but he's not a leading man kind of looking actor. He's got a pot belly, receding hairline, pudgy face. It's not Al Pacino.
No. I always go for the actor. If the actor who came in to read for this part had been Cary Grant and it had worked, I probably would have said, fine, let's do that. But we didn't. What really we were blessed enough to have happen is that James Gandolfini came through our door. And I honestly mean this. Without Jim Gandolfini, there is no Sopranos. There's no Tony Soprano. That's why the whole thing, I think, is so identifiable to so many people, because he just is so human. And people respond to him. Their hearts and their heads go out to him, despite the heinous things he's doing on screen.
There's something very average guy looking about him.
Oh, it's more than that. I don't think he is that average. I think he is a very, very sensitive, hypersensitive man. And I think he reflects his environment in a very, very rarefied way. Mm-hmm. And he comes off as the regular Joe, you know. But I think what's going on there is you have a very, very extremely emotional person and sensitive person. And that's what Tony Soprano has become as a result of him.
Edie Falco plays the role of Carmelo. What did you tell Edie Falco about the character of Carmelo after you cast her?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Just comes in, does her work.
Was Carmelo...
No direction, honest to God. No direction, no nothing. The case with most of these actors. There's very little directing going on.
When you wrote the character of Carmela, Tony's wife, did you base it on any of the people who you knew from the old neighborhood where you grew up? Because you grew up in the same township that The Sopranos is set in.
Right. Right. But when you say the old neighborhood, I think yeah. People probably get the idea of sort of like stoops and three-story, you know, brownstone houses. I grew up in the suburbs, mm-hmm. And that's where The Sopranos takes place. Were there people in my town like that? I guess, actually, when I think about it, I think she reminds me somewhat of some of my cousins.
In what way?
Very direct. They'll tell you exactly what's on their mind. My cousin Diana was a lot. I'm thinking about this for the first time. You asked me this. I've never thought about this before. I had a cousin, Diana Spizzato, who was much older than me, actually. She was a contemporary of my mother, but she was my cousin. She was my first cousin. She had this kind of... She was tough, and she had this kind of world-weariness about her. At the same time, she was a great mother and an extremely capable, sharp woman. But she... You could not push her. You know, if you did, you'd hear about it. She'd come back at you.
David Chase speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from the year 2000 with David Chase, creator of The Sopranos. The influential HBO drama series premiered 20 years ago this week.
It seems to me that The Sopranos started off with a little bit more comedy and that it's become just more tragic for the characters as time goes on.
I know. People have said that, and I didn't realize that. I don't see it that way. So it's
you don't
really
see
difficult.
It that way?
Uh-huh. I don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had a plan for Tony's emotional growth or lack of growth throughout the first season. The idea carried over from the first season was, okay, based on what we seem to remember about therapy or know about therapy, of course it takes much longer than this, and it's, you get to a point, my parents did this, my parents did that, you're slamming your parents, the shrink is saying, oh, those parents you had, what do you expect? You can't be any better than you are. And you go through that, and then you get to a point where it's okay, so your parents were your parents, now what are you going to do? You know, as a shrink once said to me, what would you like to do? Should we have an auto da fe and burn the old lady at the stake? She's your mother. What can you do about it? And so we got to that point in the show, and the second season was about Tony realizing that people kept saying to him he was his own worst enemy, that the seeds of his own destruction and his problems were internal, as they are with all of us, really. In the end, you're here, and there's no excuses for who you are. And I thought it was also necessary to remind the audience, this is a mobster. This is a gangster. You may think he's lovable. He's also a very, very scary man.
Let's hear a scene between Tony and his psychiatrist, Dr. Melfi, from about three episodes from the end of last season. And this gets a little bit to what you're talking about. This conversation isn't about Tony's mother. It's about who Tony is and the kind of problems he's responsible for of his own volition in the work that he's doing and in the crimes that he's committing. So here's Tony with Dr. Melfi.
Do you know why a shark keeps moving?
They got to keep moving or they'll die. They can't breathe or something.
There's a psychological condition known as alixithymia, common in certain personalities. The individual craves almost ceaseless action, which enables them to avoid acknowledging the abhorrent things they do.
Abhorrent? What certain personalities?
Antisocial personalities.
My future brother-in-law. Ran over a guy. No reason. Guy's paralyzed. Has to piss into a cathode tube. What happens when these antisocial personalities aren't distracted from the horrible they do?
They have time to think about their behavior. How what they do affects other people. About feelings of emptiness and self-loathing haunting them since childhood. And they crash.
The scene from The Sopranos, my guest is the creator and executive producer of the series, David Chase. Where does that scene take us in the development of Tony?
Well, it was intended to be building toward some sort of conclusion or some kind of self-awareness on Tony's part that it's no longer, you can no longer blame your parents, your mother. You cannot go through your life or go through therapy just leaning on that crutch all the time. That after a while, it's you. The problem is you. It's strange. As you were playing that scene, I felt the scene with Melfi. I felt very sorry for Tony Soprano. I actually got choked up. I sort of heard it for the first time, because she's not only saying to him, "This is what you do to other people," but she's saying to him that underneath, there's this just little scared person who just hates himself. I felt compassion for the guy.
Do you ever hear from people who are in the mob and watch the series and comment one way or another?
No, not directly. There are people who work on the show in New York who know people who know people who know people. Mm-hmm. And the word has filtered back through that pipeline that the first season, what we heard was they just were okay. That's all we ever heard. We're okay. But then recently, stories were printed about a Jersey crime family who FBI transcripts came out in which they talked about the Sopranos, and they felt that the Sopranos was based on them, which it isn't. I want to be quick to assure them. No, it is not at all. I mean, we make up a lot of this stuff, and it's interesting that it happens to coincide with what they feel is real life.
When you were growing up, were there movies that really scared the heck out of you, but you couldn't take your eyes off of them?
Oh, of course, yes. As I said, I was a scaredy kid, and yet horror movies and scary movies to me were, I could not get enough of them. I think a pretty big influence on me was this William Wellman movie, The Public Enemy, mm-hmm. which I saw on Million Dollar Movie when I was probably 8 or 9, and they would play a movie all week long. And in it, there's the gangster Tom Powers is, you know, it's the one where Cagney's finally, after this life of crime. And actually, the mother is very important in that movie, too. He's got this sort of sweet little old Irish mother. But after this horrible life of crime and smashing the grapefruit into that woman's face and everything else that he did, he gets shot and he says, "I ain't so tough," and he collapses on his knees. But at the end of the movie, he's in a hospital, and the rival gangs calls his mother's house and says, "We're sending Tom home." And his brother runs up the stairs and says, "Ma, Ma, they're bringing Tom home." And she puts on this I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles record, and it's playing, and she's making the bed, and she's sort of singing, and feathers are going every place. She's happy, and his brother's all excited. He's coming home, and then there's a knock on the door, and the brother opens the door, and you see Cagney's wrapped up in a blanket with his head all in bandages from the hospital, tied up like a mummy, and he's dead, and he's dead eyes, and he just sort of topples toward camera, right into the lens. That's the end of the movie. This was the most frightening thing I'd ever seen. I was scared about this for a month. I could not get that out of my mind.
What was it that was so scary?
I don't know to this day. This, the idea, those people's expectations in the house, it's actually making me kind of sad. I don't know, their expectations of what was going to happen and what really did happen, that they were so happy that he was coming home and he was dead in such a horrible way and how he'd wasted his life.
Well, David Chase, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with
Thank
us.
Thank you very much. It's been really great.
David Chase speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000. After a break, we'll continue our celebration of the 20th anniversary of the premiere of HBO's The Sopranos with an interview with the show's leading lady, Edie Falco. And culture critic Soraya Nadia McDonald will review this weekend's Season 3 premiere of HBO's True Detective series. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One NA. And from the Library of Congress, with the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, a program that offers thousands of books for all ages in audio and braille formats. More at 1-800-300-6000.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, we're saluting the hugely influential TV series The Sopranos, which premiered on HBO 20 years ago this week. We've already heard from the show's creator, David Chase, and now we'll listen back to Terry's 2014 interview with Edie Falco, who plays Tony's wife, Carmela, on The Sopranos. Since then, she starred on TV as a very different character, playing the title role of a drug-addicted healthcare professional in the Showtime TV series Nurse Jackie.
Jackie and Carmela are both very tough, and they have a real mouth when they need it. But Jackie lives in the world of work. You know, she's a nurse, and she's a very excellent one. And Carmela lived in the world of suburban mobster wives.
Right.
How did you talk differently in each of those roles and walk differently? Carmela was almost always wearing heels, and she had that little high-heeled mincing walk that she'd use.
You know? Yeah.
Jackie is like, she is busy at the hospital, and she is like striding around.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a really different walk.
Yeah, well, any woman knows when you put sneakers on, you walk one way. You put heels on, you walk another way. And also, Carmela's nails were a whole thing, too, that she could never really touch anything. There was always this, you know, minuscule distance between her and everything in her environment. So there was something...
Because of those really long nails?
Yeah. I mean, so I always... That somehow had something... Like, when I've looked at it, it seems like my hands were always up, like at the bent at the elbows, almost like the nails would hit something if she went too close or something. So I mean, that was a big part of it, too, being her, that she was somehow protected by armor from her whole environment in one way or another, you know, internally and externally.
Is it a relief not to be dressing in Carmela's clothes, but rather to just be wearing a blue nursing uniform a lot of the time?
Well, that was another reason for choosing this show, to be honest with you, was the low-maintenance version of it, because the whole Carmela getup was very time-consuming. And in the beginning, it was very exciting. And then, you know, whatever, 9 years in, I thought I was going to, you know, rip my hair out at the roots. But it was a big part of who she was. But when it came to choosing another, you know, another character to be for a while, that was a big part. It was also why I cut my hair. I just thought, I just want to get rid of all this stuff. But everything comes in waves. You know, a good number of years into Nurse Jackie, I thought, I want my hair back.
Yeah.
So
it's much longer now.
Yes, it is. It is.
Why did it take so long to physically become Carmela before the shoot each day?
Well, I was going to say personal style, but there is none of Jackie's. It's I'm closer to her than Carmela. I'm a very low maintenance individual myself. So I would go into the trailer on Sopranos, and I'd been there for 2 hours between the hair curling and straightening and pinning and the tons of makeup and the nails to put on and the jewelry. It was a whole – and the costume itself. There was a whole way, an order in which I had to do these things. I had to put my jewelry on before the nails because then I couldn't put it on without the nails. And I had a dog at the time who was in my trailer while I was on Sopranos, and she started to choke on a chicken bone. And I panicked, and I stuck my finger in her mouth and realized I can't reach it because of the nails. I ripped my fingernails off to get my finger down the dog's throat and pull the chicken bone out. It was just one of the many, and she was fine, but it was one of the many issues about having to be this other person.
Oh. So were they fake nails?
They were fake nails. I glued them on every day.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So you and Carmela from The Sopranos had similar problems, teenage kids who were rebelling, talking back to you,
mm-hmm.
which I suppose is pretty typical.
Well, yeah. I was going to say Jackie, Carmela, and every mother I've ever heard of.
Yeah. Right. And you've both tried, you know, both characters have tried tough love in ways that aren't necessarily very effective.
Right.
So you have two children, age 9 and 6. Can you imagine saying any of the things that Jackie or Carmela have said to their teenagers?
I would like to say no. But the things that go on in parenting, I've been shocked by my own reactions to things, my children's reactions to my reactions. They kind of are otherworldly. There is very little that brings out more deep-seated stuff than the parent-child relationship I've found. You don't even know what's going to come out of your mouth when you feel as helpless as you sometimes do in the face of a smart kid.
What's an example of something that you've said that's really surprised you?
Oh, gosh. This is going to be terrible. But I'll tell you, my son was issue with coming into my bed. This is some years ago now. And he kept coming in my bed in the middle of the night when I'm half asleep. I was working at the time, so I was getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And he came into my bed, and I think the words were, if you don't get out of my bed, I will throw you down the stairs. My son looked at me wide-eyed and went back into bed. And then in the morning he said, did you say last night that you were going to throw me down the stairs? And I was like blushing. I said, Anderson, I said that to you. And I cannot believe I said it has become now something we joke about. And every once in a while, he's like, what, are you going to throw me down the stairs? I'm like, Anderson, I am sorry. I'm not responsible for what I say at 3 a.m. when I'm not getting sleep. So anyway, yes, it's really insane what happens under dire circumstances, lack of sleep and you know, kids who want their way. So anyway, I'm not proud of that. And I'm, you know, deeply working on it, let's just say.
Edie Falco speaking to Terry Gross in 2014. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And from the School of the New York Times, offering a 2-week summer academy for high school students who want to live and learn in New York and Washington, D.C., while studying with Times journalists. Application info at nytedu.com.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2014 interview with Edie Falco. She co-starred as Carmela Soprano, the wife of Tony Soprano, in HBO's The Sopranos, which premiered 20 years ago this week.
You know what I was wondering? One of the defining traits of Carmela, Tony Soprano's wife, is that she's in such denial. I mean, she knows what she wants to know when she needs to know it, and when she doesn't need to know it and wants to deny it, she doesn't know it. So she really knows that Tony is, you know, the head of the mob in his part of Jersey.
Right.
But she knows, she doesn't know the specific details of, like, who he's beaten up or who he's ordered killed or who he's extorting. But, you know, she gets the gist of it. But, you know, she acts very innocent about it unless she wants to intimidate somebody. And in that case, like, her husband's Tony Soprano. Do you know who he is?
Right.
But anyways, I was wondering if you almost protected yourself from watching some episodes so that you wouldn't know what Carmela wouldn't know about the actual acts of brutality that Tony was responsible for, or, you know, the person himself who was doing the killing or the
brutalizing. I never thought of that. That's actually highly possible. I was aware more about I didn't want to see him with other women.
Really?
That was the part that I found harder to, that Edie found harder to see. There was no way I couldn't let it get into my system in a way that would bother me. It gets very complicated, this stuff, you know, this whole acting stuff. And not just, it's not just a play or a movie. This went on for 10 years. So there is this alter ego thing about what actually goes on that the character slash me that I don't know about. So, yeah, I think on some level, to protect myself from the other women, I didn't watch it so much. But I had less of a hard time about the people he was killing, which I'm sure is more for me and my shrink to talk about, but we'll get to that.
I think Carmela might have been that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you couldn't,
that's right.
You couldn't watch any of it because Tony was with a woman on just about every episode.
Hey, I still haven't watched them, so don't tell me.
you're in for some heartbreak.
I'm still in, you know, whatever. 10 years later, I'm still in denial.
Well, your characters used to fight a lot, and I thought I'd play an example of one of the fights. And this is a session, your first session with Tony's therapist, Dr. Melfi, who's played by Lorraine Bracco, and you're there with Tony to, you know, talk about his anxiety attacks, and of course, it ends up in a big fight. So, here's the scene.
Anthony's attacks, how do they make you feel? Well, concerned, of course. Helpless. A little frustrated, maybe.
With your inability to help him?
To tell the truth, I was referring to your inability to help him.
She has helped me. What are you talking about?
You've been coming here for 3 years, Tony. You still pass out on a regular basis.
I understand your frustration. Did Anthony share with you any of our insights about his last panic attack?
I told you, remember? The gabagool and my mother when I was a little kid.
Right, yes.
Do you think that there's anything in the present family dynamic that could serve as a trigger? Something in your dialoguing, perhaps?
Excuse me?
I don't really know you that well. We're trying to get to root causes.
Like maybe you do things, you know, that have some effect on me.
Oh, really?
What? People affect each other in life.
Oh, I get it. Is this how it works? You can't get any answers out of him, so you start looking for someone else to point the finger at?
She's not saying anything. Why are you getting so defensive?
You know what, Tony? Maybe you should explore your own behavior. Maybe you pass out because you're guilty over something. Maybe the fact that you stick your into anything with a pulse, you ever thought of exploring that as a root cause?
Very nice. That's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I told you months ago I broke it off with that Russian person, right?
It's incredible. It's like people who smoke their whole lives and then they sue the cigarette companies when they get cancer.
You know, you agreed to come here. Ah, forget it. This is ridiculous.
Right, just sit there. Silence. Anger. And then you pass out and you blame the rest of the world.
Yeah, I love you too.
It's a scene from The Sopranos with my guest Edie Falco and with James Gandolfini and Lorraine Bracco. What was it like for you to listen to that?
Oh, my gosh, so bizarre. It's like another life, another lifetime, a lifetime ago. I had a million thoughts. But I forgot how good the writing is and how funny it is and how much dimension each of the characters have. And, you know, the sound of each voice is so familiar and so kind of not forgotten, but certainly far away. So it's a big deal.
You were saying earlier, though, when you would have a fight with one, a fight in character with one of your children on The Sopranos, when the scene was over, you'd give them a big hug just so that they knew the difference between your real feelings about them and Carmela's anger at their character. So when you would have a big fight with Tony, which you would do frequently on The Sopranos, would you and James Gandolfini express your genuine appreciation and respect for each other afterwards?
No.
Not necessary because we're adults?
We're adults, yeah, we're adults. And also, I've said before also that Jim and I, we didn't know each other all that well, really. We didn't socialize much, and it was not on purpose, I don't think, or at least not consciously so. But, and I can only speak for myself, but I think because of that, or maybe because I wanted that to be the case, is he really existed only as Tony to me. So, because there wasn't really a lot of information about Jim, the guy who showed up to play Tony. So, you know, it a lot of it felt pretty real. And just to sort of jump back to our real people at the end of a scene would have felt less satisfying for me. You know, we pretty much were husband and wife when we were on that set, and it made an exquisitely satisfying acting experience for sure, and, you know, world experience. But, yeah, the fact that we were very much Tony and Carmela.
Were you particularly sad when he died that you never got to know him as a man?
You know, that's a complicated question. Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I love Jim very much, but we both had very, very full lives on different sides of the country. And the nature of this business that I'm in is so bizarre that you can have that kind of close, however pretend, relationship with an actor and then not really have them in your life much at all afterwards. I think it's more the rule than not that... you know, you move on to another project and those people become your family. It's sort of definitely an odd career choice for someone who, you know, like anybody who wants connection.
What was your audition like for The Sopranos?
Was that the Mayflower Hotel on Central Park West, which I think is gone now, I guess. And I was very busy at the time, and I was told that it was an audition for a thing called Sopranos, and I figured it was about singers, but I would just go in and do it anyway. I went in there, and it was David Chase and, a couple other people. Johnny Ventimiglia, who ended up playing Artie Bucco, was reading the part of Tony Soprano.
Artie Bucco has the Italian restaurant that they hang out in. Yeah,
exactly. And he was reading the part of Tony in the audition, and a couple other people were there, but I don't remember quite so well. And I went in, and I just did exactly what I knew this character should be in my mind, from my estimation, also knowing that there's no way I would get cast because... I was not the stereotypical Italian-American-looking actress, and I knew who was, and I thought there's something very powerful about going in to just do it for the heck of it. You know, and there's, of course, a huge lesson in there. You know, life is the pain in life is contingent upon one's expectations for the most part. So if I went in there just to sort of enjoy the day, which is what I did, you tend to show your best self. So anyway, what I was calm and relaxed. And so I did this audition, and then he asked me to read some other scene, and I left, and that was the end of that. And I got a call, I think, like that day or the next day, and from Meg Mortimer, my agent at the time, who said, yeah, they want you to do this thing. And I thought, oh, wow. And it was a monstrous sum of money for me at the time. And all I thought was, I cannot believe I can pay off my student loan with one check, with this one check that I'm going to get. It was like I broke out in a sweat at the size of that relief because, you know, money, a constant source of anguish in my life. A huge piece of it was just eaten up by this check I was going to get, which was, of course, it was this great job, which was just a pilot at the time. But, you know, money for a struggling actor is a very, very big deal. Not news to anybody, I'm sure.
So you grew up on Long Island in New York. Describe your neighborhood.
Well, I grew up on the South Shore originally, down in West Islip. And the neighborhood was all kids my age. And as I have said recently, that I don't remember having shoes on for much of my childhood. I was a real tomboy. I was always beating up the neighborhood boys and riding my bike and trying to show off and climbing trees. And I was always cut up, had, you know, scabs on my knees. I was a real tough little girl, I guess. But I remember it being like a big, giant, safe place because at every home was one of my friends, a kid that I walked to school with or spent the summers building tree forts with or whatever we used to do. But that was on until high school, I guess. And after middle school, I moved to Northport, New York, which was a stunning town on the water.
So earlier you said you were a goody two-shoes when you were young.
Yeah. Well, I didn't do any bad stuff.
You were just beating up the boys in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, they'd say, what was the expression? I call you out. And it was like, you want to call me out, you're going to get it. And I sent one kid to the hospital. I pushed him down really hard and gravel went into his knee. He never bothered me again. I'll tell you that much.
I
was goody two shoes.
Some real like tough. Tough.
Yeah, I suppose I do. I suppose I do. Yeah, from my early days. But I also did my schoolwork, and I, you know, was a good kid. I never, I wasn't particularly rebellious at all, actually.
Well, Edie Falco, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
Edie Falco speaking to Terry Gross in 2014. She co-starred in The Sopranos, the HBO series that premiered 20 years ago this week on January 10th, 1999. The Sopranos ran for 6 seasons. Its final episode was in June 2007.
I went ahead and ordered Chef for the tape.
Coming up, culture critic Soraya Nadia McDonald reviews Sunday's new season of the HBO series True Detective. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. 5 years ago, HBO grabbed the country's attention with a new anthology drama series called True Detective. The show suffered under the weight of its own hype and turned out a disappointing second season. Now it's back, starring Mahershala Ali, who recently won a Golden Globe for his supporting role in the film Green Book. Culture critic Soraya Nadia McDonald says the third season of True Detective is a welcome return to its introspective roots.
When True Detective debuted, it became an internet sensation because of all the ways its creator, Nick Pizzolatto, upended the buddy cop genre. There were its movie star leads, Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey, crossing over into premium cable. Its meandering plot steeped viewers in a moody Southern Gothic setting. Its director, Cary Joji Fukunaga, dragged cinematic conventions into television with an unforgettable tracking shot. And Pizzolatto loaded his scripts with philosophical aphorisms inspired by the Robert Chambers collection, The King in Yellow. Now back for a third season, Pizzolatto has regained his footing and the magic in his pen. This time, he defies expectations by turning a cop drama into a meditation on social isolation. He details the way adult biases and self-interests fail the most vulnerable members of a society, its children. Mahershala Ali is remarkable as the embittered, antisocial Wayne Hayes, a Vietnam vet who craves little more than the company of liquor and an empty VFW hall. He and his partner Roland West, played by Stephen Dorff, are detectives with the Arkansas State Police. A white high school student, Will Purcell, and his older sister Julie have disappeared in 1980 from their tiny, mostly white, mostly poor town of West Finger, Arkansas. Director Jeremy Saulnier's timeline jumps from 1980 to 1990, when the case is reopened, to 2015, when a journalist interviews Hayes about his work. Hayes, meanwhile, is struggling to sort out what happened before the fog of Alzheimer's permanently clouds his brain. Depicting Hayes, especially as an elderly man weighted with regrets, is an exercise in restraint. Ali pulls it off with aplomb. Black residents don't trust Hayes because he wears a police badge. At the precinct, his instincts carry less weight than his white partner's. Hayes knows his race limits his professional progress. It fuels the way he pulls away from people, which in turn worsens his prospects for advancement. Pizzolatto understands that the racial dynamics of West Finger don't just create divisions, they force people together, too. Hayes marries the only other middle-class black person in town, Will Purcell's high school English teacher, Amelia Reardon, played with deceptive ease by Carmen Ejogo. They expertly recreate the instant rapport that forms between black people who've never met, casually chatting about everyday racism like they're discussing the weather. You know they're talking about white people, even if they never say white people.
How long you been teaching?
About 6 years.
All at West Mead?
Yes, sir.
Hey, you say, sir, I start looking for my boss.
No, I'm sorry. Just, you know, police.
How is it here? You know.
It's fine. It's good, really, for what it is. I hear something now and then. They're all poor around here, that's the main thing.
What you hear now and then?
You know, a word in the hallway or something. They're careful around me.
The kinship between Amelia and Hayes could be deeper, but Hayes remains distant. Amelia takes an interest in the Purcell case, and her amateur sleuthing turns up valuable clues. But Hayes, too consumed with his own frustrations, can't appreciate his wife's efforts, nor her skill. This, perhaps, is the biggest improvement of the whole series. Amelia is nothing like the feebly drawn female characters of the first season. She has real purpose. The first two episodes move like molasses on a cold morning, but it soon becomes clear that everyone in West Finger, including Hayes, his wife, his partner, and the parents of the missing Purcell children, is starved for connection. Nevertheless, they keep erecting walls to divide themselves from each other. In doing so, they repeatedly obstruct the best chances they have to find out what happened to Will and Julie. The production design reinforces West Finger's grimness. The town is full of rusted-out cars and ramshackle houses, and everything exists in a palette of dull browns and miserable grays. I've seen 5 of this season's 8 episodes, and the most compelling mystery of True Detective is understanding why Hayes has withdrawn from the world around him. It's also about how that withdrawal is a response to larger societal forces, including, but not limited to, racism. At this point, I'm wondering, can a man who spent decades most comfortable inside his own head forge enough connections in time to solve the case that's haunted him? Or will Alzheimer's doom him and the Purcell children forever?
Soraya Nadia McDonald is the culture critic for The Undefeated. True Detective returns to HBO this Sunday. On Monday's Fresh Air, notes from a transplant surgeon. Dr. Joshua Mesrich talks about the thrill of implanting a new organ and changing a patient's life, and about some operations that didn't go so well. His new book is part memoir and part history of organ transplantation. It's called When Death Becomes Life. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Teresa Madden directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire. And from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization offering educational learning adventures for families, grandparents, and grandchildren. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org.